repast is a meal shared by family members and friends to grieve and celebrate the life of a loved one after a funeral. While many communities use repasts, they have particular significance in the African American community. During the Jim Crow era, when segregation extended to funerals and burials, the African American community imported West African funeral traditions, including the repast. Here's Scott Barton, a chef and professor of food studies at NYU.
You know that as a culture, we had funerary societies because of Jim Crow. We couldn't use undertakers.
Mm-hmm.
And so historically, part of this repast, it comes out of African tradition, but you were laid out in your front room.
Mm.
And they literally, the tradition usually meant you had to take off the door, front or side door to the house, or the front window to get the coffin in and out. And then often in those situations, the repast meal is laid, because people would come sit with the body until the Black Burial Society, which usually paid dues to on the eventuality of somebody dying, took the body away. But you often had the repast with the body still there.
Over the past year, with the very public loss of so many Black lives, the repast has been on the minds of many, including Professor Barton.
And because of where we were at, and maybe because of what had been in my mind, I made another repast. The repast I made was more conceptual, and it was made in honor, memory, as individual and archetype, for Ahmaud Arbery, Breonna Taylor, George Floyd, and kind of the phoenix from the ashes of Jacob Blake, who lived and get shot.
The repast at the heart of our new season was actual rather than conceptual. And it focuses on another Black life lost, not to death, but incarceration. And yet that very repast, which has caused so much pain and anguish to a family, has empowered them, and might hold the key to setting their loved one free. And that freedom could come before the end of this season.
Hi and welcome to Undisclosed, the State versus Darrell Ewing. This is the first episode in a four-episode series about Darrell Ewing, who was in prison serving a life without parole sentence for the 2009 murder of J.B. Watson in Detroit, Michigan. My name is Rabia Chaudhry. I'm an attorney and author of the New York Times bestseller, A Non-Story. And as always, I'm joined by my co-hosts Susan Simpson and Colin Miller.
Hi, this is Susan Simpson. I'm an attorney in Washington, D.C., and I blog at The View from LL2.
Hi, this is Colin Miller. I'm an associate dean and professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law, and I blog at Evidence Prof Blog.
On December 29, 2009, J.B. Watson was fatally shot at the intersection of Harper and Van Dyke in the east side of Detroit. This recent news clip from WDIV sets the scene.
According to prosecutors, two cars pulled up to this east side intersection. In one was J.B. Watson, his girlfriend, and his cousin. In the other, two Black men. One of those men got out and fired multiple shots, killing Watson.
Actually, at the time of the shooting at about 3:40 p.m., there were three people in the car with Watson. His girlfriend, Loretta Thomas, and his cousins, Philip Reed and Willie Williams. And none of them were able to identify the shooter. But Willie Williams had been in the car, which was a red burgundy Astro van, earlier in the day with Watson and Thomas. According to Williams, the three of them left Thomas's place at about 11 a.m., with Loretta Thomas driving. Now, at trial, Williams testified that soon after they started driving, they came upon three men getting into a white Impala, a man named Darrell Ewing and twins named Damari and Dante Morris. Williams testified that the two vehicles then engaged in a game of cat and mouse, with Ewing driving the Impala and cutting them off and mean mugging at them, and Watson making Thomas drive down side streets to evade them. That's what Williams testified to at trial, but that's not what he initially told police officers on the day of the shooting. It appears that the first officer Williams spoke to was Officer Arthur Matthews for about 30 minutes. And according to Officer Matthews, Williams told him that they'd had a problem with the twins earlier in the day, but he made no reference to Darrell Ewing being present. And then there was Police Officer Crystal Scott. She testified at Darrell Ewing's preliminary hearing that Williams told her that they'd had an encounter with the twins in a white Impala, but made no mention of Darrell Ewing. Finally, there was Theopolis Williams, who would become the officer in charge of the case. Officer Williams testified that Willie Williams told him about seeing the white Impala and did mention both the twins and Darrell Ewing. But he would also go on to testify that Williams never said that Ewing was driving the Impala, and he never said that the Impala was chasing them or cut them off. Instead, all he said was that the guys in the Impala were clowning. And then there's the mean mugging. Well, unlike the girls in Exhibit's song, if Willie Williams saw something, he didn't say anything. Because according to Officer Williams, he made no reference to Darrell Ewing mean mugging. Rather, Willie Williams would testify at trial that, until the day in question, he'd never had any beef with Darrell Ewing or the twins. And then there's Loretta Thomas. As the driver of the van, you might expect her to have a memory of having to make evasive maneuvers in response to being threatened by someone with a clear case of road rage. But no, Thomas never mentions this prior incident at all in her testimony.
But both Thomas and Williams did, of course, testify about the shooting later in the day. According to Thomas, she'd been at her place getting ready for her 4 p.m. shift at work when Watson arrived with Williams, Philip Reed, and her Astro van. She got in the driver's seat and started driving, eventually stopping at a red light at the intersection of Harper and Van Dyke in the east side of Detroit. That's when she heard 3 gunshots and looked over her right shoulder, seeing a young black man pointing a gun at the van. Realizing Watson had been shot and fearing further gunfire, she slammed her foot in the accelerator and hit 2 cars that were in the way and then plowed towards the hospital. Meanwhile, Willie Williams testified that he was in the rear passenger seat behind Thomas. Williams said that when they first stopped at the intersection of Harper and Van Dyke, he'd heard something that sounded like rocks hitting the back of the minivan. And then he heard shattering glass and realized they were being shot at. He saw Watson slump down and told Thomas to hotfoot it out of there. Finally, Philip Reed testified that he'd been seated behind J.B. Watson in the van. According to Reed, before the shooting, he and Williams had smoked some weed in the van. Then, when they'd stopped at the intersection, he'd heard a gunshot that broke the glass of the van's back window. And then he heard a second shot that hit the ring finger on his hand, taking a piece of it off. At trial, he would joke that the finger was a bit shorter than it used to be. He also recalled that Thomas had driven like a madwoman to the hospital after the van had been shot up. According to the prosecution, the hospital in question was about 10 minutes away from Harper and Van Dyke. And hospital notes from the nurse who treated J.B. Watson showed that she started triaging him at 3:53 p.m. So if you account for a few minutes before Watson got to the nurse, the shooting occurred at around 3:40 p.m. So those are the 2 key times that you need to know about this case. The first is that shortly after 11 a.m., there was some type of incident with a white Impala. And second, at around 3:40 p.m., someone shot J.B. Watson, a shot that would prove fatal. And based upon Willie Williams' eventual statement about the Impala and other evidence we'll discuss in later episodes, the police believe that the shooter was Darrell Ewing. So, who is Darrell Ewing?
Darrell Ewing was born on November 18, 1988, and grew up in East Detroit. And what was that area like when you were growing up in the 90s?
It was a nice neighborhood, I guess. It wasn't how they paint the Detroit to be on TV or anything. You know what I mean? It was actually a nice area that we stayed in off of Warren and Buckingham growing up.
Darrell's family members describe him as entrepreneurial. At age 10, he started a landscaping company, and we're not just talking about a couple of guys cutting grass.
Oh, yeah. I actually had a landscaping company called Two Men's in the Florida that I had coming up as a job, me and my friends. We used to have over 35 customers that we do bi-weekly.
Part of the motivation for starting this business was providing for his family.
About my childhood, I remember being the only boy. I was sort of the man in the household at times, a young man, so I had a lot of stress responsibilities of protecting my sisters and stuff. I used to cook for them and all types of things, even when my mother wasn't even around.
Darrell wasn't just entrepreneurial. He was smart, really smart. Here's his mom, Lasagna Dodson.
And I can say that Darrell did. Darrell went to school. He went to Denby. When he was over there, he got all A's and B's.
Mm-hmm.
They got into one altercation with a kid. I took him out of Denby, and I put him in East Catholic. He was my only son. Mm-hmm. He don't come from a family that didn't care about him. If I got to pay for you to get better schooling and get around other people, I'm putting you over here. He graduated at 16.
So what was Catholic school like for Darrell?
You know, it was a Catholic school, so it was had to wear a uniform, and it was like nuns and everything there. It was actually kind of different, you know what I mean, than the average Detroit public schools.
After graduating high school with a 3.8 GPA, Darrell enrolled in Wayne State University to study business. But another business he'd started sidetracked those plans.
Well, I got accepted to Wayne State, but I had family members who went to college, and they never did anything with their degree, so eventually I was already throwing parties by that time, and the money was coming in lucrative, so there was no need for school at that time to me at that hour. You know, I think I had thought I found my spot in life.
Right, so you're doing some party planning, you're making some good money and deciding, I can just do this, I don't need to get my degree.
Right.
And that's in college? Is it when you formed the Hustle Boys, or is that after?
The Hustle Boys was formed way back in high school. We used to do parties in high schools and formed the Hustle Boys.
So in high school, you start the Hustle Boys, you start throwing parties, you're throwing them at Wayne State as well, right? And that becomes eventually your business?
Yeah, that came my business. Yeah, that's basically a prime source of income, and it was fun while making money, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So with Darrell having turned 21 in November 2009 and running his party planning business, we can now fast forward a month to December 29th, 2009, the day that J.B. Watson was fatally shot. You'll recall that Willie Williams eventually came to testify that Darrell Ewing was mean mugging at him shortly after 11 a.m. Well, there was a funeral held on the 29th between 10:30 a.m. and 12 or 12:30 p.m. It was a funeral for Darrell's grandmother's best friend, Gloria Chesternut, who is also the godmother of his mom and aunts. A trial exhibit confirms trial testimony that this funeral was held that day at the Cantrell Funeral Home in Detroit. Darrell's aunt, Keisha Taylor, distinctly remembers the funeral.
I mean, we was all getting together to go to the funeral. Everybody was getting ready, of course. We all, of course, stayed in different places, but we were all, you know, gathering to get ready to go to the funeral. We all met up at the funeral. That's, you know, where we all were. All of our family, all of the Chestnuts families.
At trial, Taylor testified that she arrived at the funeral at about 10 a.m. so she could see Gloria's body before the ceremony started, and then left between noon and 12:30 p.m. when the funeral ended. And she also testified that Darrell was at the funeral. Janice Jenkins, another aunt, testified that she arrived at the funeral a bit late, about 11 a.m., stayed until the end, and was positive that Darrell was there. Finally, a third aunt, Cherise Sanders, testified that she arrived at the funeral between 10:30 and 11 a.m., was there throughout the procession, and remembered seeing Darrell there as well. Now recall, Willie Wilson eventually placed Darrell Ewing in a white Impala chasing the Astra van around Detroit shortly after 11 a.m. this very same day. But here we have three witnesses placing Darrell Ewing at a documented funeral between roughly 10:30 a.m. and sometime between 12 and 12:30 p.m. if you believe these three aunts, Willie Wilson has to be lying or mistaken. And then, shortly after the funeral, from about 1 to 4:45 or 5 p.m., there was a repast for Gloria Chesternut at Barton Hall in Detroit. And this takes us back to Scott Barton and the original inspiration for his social justice repast. Someone near and dear to my heart, Breonna Taylor.
The thing that I was so tickled by with Breonna about never writing down the recipe for the chili that her mother made, but wanting to call her mother, which seemed pretty regular after she got off shift at the hospital.
Yeah.
Which I saw, and it's my conjecture, to be a way to just extend our relationship. And as you, I don't know if you have kids or siblings, but we lose the ability to have regular coming together with all of our schedules.
Mm-hmm.
So if her mom's off on shift and she's off shift, it just, that human touch, it's almost like a little hug. Because in several of the articles that came up, that was one of the first things about her. Her mother said, why don't you write it down? And then there's laughter in the background of her coworkers, knowing once again Brianna's calling to ask, what do I put in the chili? I'm getting off shift. I want to go to the market to buy chili to make chili when I get home.
Darrell Ewing had a similar relationship with his aunt Cherie Sanders, and a literal hug helps to bolster his afternoon alibi that he was at the repast.
So a repast is the family gets together and you have food and you celebrate the life of the person. Is that basically what a repast is?
Right, right.
Okay. And I think you testified at trial that you remember Darrell coming in because you were near to the door and he came in and gave you a hug and a kiss.
Right. Like, man, I'm super close. Honestly, we super close. He, like, my first kid, you know,
mm-hmm.
basically. I taught him how to cook. Like, all kind of stuff. Like, we super duper close. Even now, like, we mm-hmm. never, it never changed. So, even through all of this.
Janice Jenkins gave similar testimony, and Darrell's third aunt, Keisha Taylor, has an even more specific memory.
Yeah, that was, yeah. Because we came in, when he came in, like, I was so heartbroken because I was really close to Gloria, so. But I just remember, like, him coming in, you know, hey, sweet tea, you know, and giving me, like, a really big hug. And he always gave, like, the best really strong hugs. And so, because he, you know, he was kind of like one of the men in our family, you know,
mm-hmm.
Being one of the older boys. So we got more girls in our family than boys. So with him being, you know, like one of the older boys, he was always so comforting to everybody. So, you know. I just remember him hugging me tight, like, you know, it's going to be all right, you know, she okay, you know, because her and my mom were so close, and we lost our mother when we were a little younger, and so mm-hmm. it was like, it kind of hit her, you know, that she had died too, so.
Keisha Taylor also has another memory of Darrell at the repast, and this ties into one of the original purposes of repast in the African-American community. Again, here's Scott Barton from the introduction.
So the repast is similar. It has two functions in an African American tradition as a rite of passage. It is a way to bring together family and community in ways analogous to the Jewish sitting of the Shiva.
Mm-hmm.
And so the family does little, and so food is brought to them that is not only for that meal, but is to start a tradition for at least a short term of the local cooks, usually women, bringing food to the house so they don't have to do work.
As in the old days, Keisha was distraught at the loss of her godmother and recalls her nephew bringing her food when it was served in the 2 o'clock hour.
I'm telling you, I was a whole basket case.
Uh-huh.
I was just sitting there and he made me a plate and all that.
And I know it's been a long time now, but do you have any recollection of the food that was served there at the repast that he was getting for you?
It probably was most of the basics, you know, chicken and string beans, I don't know, mac and cheese. It's the, you know, I don't want to sound, but it's the basic of what African Americans cook for every situation, whether it's a wedding, funeral, whatever. So I'm assuming it was just basic stuff. And I'm a real picky eater, so
uh-huh.
he probably just got me like chicken and string beans and macaroni and cheese, because I'm really picky, so.
So the aunts say that these hugs happened at about 1:30 p.m. and Darrell brought Keisha Taylor food when it was served in the 2 o'clock hour. So how about the 3 o'clock hour? As noted, based upon the time when the nurse started triaging J.B. Watson, the state's estimate was that he was shot at about 3:40 p.m. Can Darrell Ewing's family account for his presence at the repast at that time? It turns out the answer is yes. And this ties into the digital version of an analog repast tradition, sharing the story of the deceased person's life. Again, here's Scott Barton.
Some kind of documentation of who they were in life at one point, obviously that would have probably been reading or oral storytelling. You would see in the probably the 30s and 40s, home movies are like Super 8, for people who had that capability, or photographs. Mm-hmm. Yes, that it would be customary. And now today, what you usually see is those endless slideshows, whether it's in a real slide projector or through a computer, and it's on its cycle just keeps running. And so sometimes you hit some people who have a little tech savvy will set up a computer. Mm-hmm. Or a projection through technology, and it just is maybe 20 slides that keep rotating,
right,
to show who that person was.
At Gloria Chesternut's repast, there was indeed such a computer slideshow, but unfortunately, most of the people in attendance were not tech savvy, except for Darrell Ewing. Here's Darrell's mother, Lasagna Dodson.
Oh, I remember it like it was yesterday, because it plays over and over in my head. They had a slideshow and everything going for her at the repast, just showing her life, you know, like a history of her life. And they couldn't get it up, so Darrell and Murray and them helped to set it up, and they had to run it because we kind of don't know all the technology stuff. So you need the younger people to help you with that. So I remember it because they were standing there, we were laughing and everything, and didn't have a clue that we would be going through something like this after. But they were there. They were there with us.
Darrell's aunt, Keisha Taylor, has a similar memory of him helping with the slideshow.
They was having some difficulties getting it to play or whatever. And like I said, he's always been really smart and he's like kind of tech savvy and stuff like that. And so I just remember him going up there like, let me help them, you know, fix the TV and all that. So he went up there and like helped them get it to play.
Darrell's other aunts also remember him helping with the slideshow. Janice Jenkins testified that he was helping with the TV, setting up the TV for the slideshow and the pictures. Finally, his other aunt, Cherise Sanders, testified as follows.
You remember seeing him after that time at the hall as the repast is occurring?
Yeah, he was helping my god sister set up. Like, they had a projector to show, like, pictures of my mom, their mom, and, like, us growing up and stuff like that.
All right, were the pictures that were shown, you said that Mr. Ewing gave assistance to that?
With a projector.
Were those pictures shown at the very beginning of the repast, or towards the end of the repast, or what time frame?
Closer towards the end.
And you distinctly remember Mr. Ewing helping with that, is that right?
Yes.
Sanders' placement of the slideshow toward the end of the repast is critical. She testified that the repast ended between 4:45 and 5 p.m., and Darrell helped to set up the slideshow at approximately 3:45, about an hour before the repast ended. Janice Jenkins also testified that Darrell helped with the slideshow shortly before it started at about 3:45 to 4 p.m. Further, Keisha Taylor testified that Darrell helped with the slideshow before it started at about 4 p.m. And finally, Darrell's mother, Lasagna Dodson, testified that her daughter, Sieta, left the repast for about half an hour at 3 p.m. to go to the store and returned about half an hour later with the Darrell soon thereafter helping to set up the slideshow. In other words, if you believe Darrell's mothers and aunts, he was at Barden Hall, helping to set up the slideshow at essentially the same time that somebody killed J.B. Watson, about 5.5 miles away.
Meanwhile, Darrell himself has a similar recollection.
What do you recall about helping to set up the slideshow at the repast?
Oh yeah, me and Deontay ran the slideshow on all the past history of Miss Chestnut and the family and everything, just captivating all the years over the years of her life.
And what was the setup in terms of that slideshow? Was that sort of an old school slideshow? Was that something done in a computer?
It was something done on like the computer, which you project onto the screen. You get the projection, it goes on the projection screen, and we ran it like that.
According to Durrell, he never left the repast until it was over. He didn't know J.B. Watson and did not kill him.
Was there any point at which you left the repast during that afternoon?
I left the repast at the very end of it.
Right.
When it was over.
But between like 1:30 when you arrive and 5 when you leave, there's no point at which you leave the repast.
Oh, no point.
Did you know J.B. Watson?
No, I did not know him.
Okay. And so you heard that night that he had been killed. What was your reaction when you heard that he'd been killed?
I mean, it was a sad moment, but it didn't really, you know, I heard about it and it was keep on moving.
Because you don't know him and you've maintained all these years, right, that you had nothing to do with his death.
Yeah, I had nothing to do with the case. I didn't know him. You know, people die in Detroit every day. You know what I mean? When I heard it, I kept on moving. It was really nothing that affected me or dealt with me because I didn't know him personally.
Durrell's aunts and mother all also testified that they knew that Durrell never left the repast because they'd been seated at a table that was close to the entry and exit doors at Barton Hall, and they would have seen him exiting and re-entering. Beyond the fact that Durrell is their nephew and son, this is why it's personal for Durrell's aunt and mother. They know for a fact that they were with him at the exact time of the crime that has led to him being locked up for the past decade. Each of them expressed how they wouldn't be fighting for his freedom after all these years if they didn't know he was innocent, because that's not the kind of family they are. For example, here's his aunt, Keisha Taylor.
It's been a very heartbreaking situation. It's been a heartbreaking situation. It's part of one of the reasons why I originally moved from Detroit, because I just feel like the justice system here, and don't get me wrong, I was born and raised here, but I feel like our justice system here is so very unfair. It's so crooked and stuff like that. And, you know, I just always wanted you know, justice for my nephew, because at the end of the day, he didn't do this. And I just felt like it was unfair. And it's so hurtful to see him spend this much time in his life locked up, you know what I'm saying, for mm-hmm. something he really didn't do. If he did something, we're the type of family, we hold our kids to the, you know, to it. If you do something, you know, because every action has a reaction, you know, and if you do something, you know, but this he didn't do, and it's just so unfair. And for us already not to have that many men in our family as it is, to have the, you know, one taken away from the few, it's heartbreaking. It's very heartbreaking.
Meanwhile, for Durrell's mother, LaSonia Dodson, things are even more visceral.
They were there. They were there with us. If we wouldn't exhaust everything we have been fighting, protesting, traveling. We'd have been to every court. We've been in front of 11 judges. Because if my son was one who would have murdered somebody, so I'm thinking about how much I love him, I would send him all of the food and stuff. I'll still support him in prison, but I wouldn't bankrupt myself. You know, my daughter is out of the military with migraines. And all kind of things that happened to her from this whole thing. We completely messed up. Like the day he went to jail, my administration stopped because my body, it hit me so hard. And just ended.
Right.
Like, it was that traumatic to me.
Sure.
Just knowing he innocent, it would have been different if we're like, dang, I wish he wouldn't have did that. Boy, why, you know, it's easy to do that. But when somebody and you didn't talk to people and they is coming for it and you still convict them, we were distraught. They literally had to drag us out of there. We almost all had to go to jail.
But while LaSonia Dodson was stunned by her son's conviction, it is her conviction and her belief that her son is innocent that has kept her fighting for him for all of these years.
I mean, this has been like a horror movie that won't end. You hear me?
Yeah, well, tell me, I mean, how much of an emotional and financial strain has it been on you to fight this all these years?
Well, I was working for Xfinity doing their marketing. I ended up taking my 401k I had to quit my job because at this point, I'm going to court too much. I'm going to lose the job at this point. So I went on a leave. I was a licensed esthetician. So I ended up paying for his lawyers and stuff. And then I ended up starting a small lash business for lash extensions and microblading and stuff. Luckily, this is a booming business that then kept me afloat. So the guy gave me this craft just so I could get through this, you know.
Yeah.
It has been enough money for me to keep money on the phone for him and him not to be there without us having to ask people and borrow all the time and things like that. It has been phenomenal as far as that. I wiped out all 401ks. My daughter works for Chrysler. One was in the military. We all band together and we all stood up for him.
These impacts haven't been felt just by Darrell's mother, but instead by his whole extended family. Here's Darrell's aunt, Cherise Sanders.
It's like I said, this has been a whole family thing. Like, we all is affected. Everybody have, just wanted to make sure he had food, make sure he had, can call whenever. Like I said, just from the mental anguish of thinking of what he might be thinking. So anytime he wanted to call, we wanted to make sure he could talk. Anything he need, food or whatever, because they served him a bunch of garbage. Even one of the facilities he was in, they had like sued the people because they were like feeding them old food and maggots and all kind of stuff. So they like sued the facility because they like treat them, not even like humans. And just imagine to not be being treated like human and you already being locked up for something that you didn't even do,
Mm-hmm.
So it's been a constant. Making sure that money is on his account or money is on his phones and stuff like that. Make sure you have a secure pack so that you can have food and everything. And just the visits, they've had him like 5 hours away. We have to drive over the Mackinac Bridge and all kind of stuff through rough weather or whatever because we was, we've been going no matter what.
According to Cherise, though, there's one person who has been especially strong and resilient over the past decade.
He's amazing, honestly, and the strongest person that I know personally because I would have fell apart on day one in the courtroom, like when they even did the sentencing. But he haven't gotten bitter through this experience, even though he know he innocent. We all know he innocent. And the fact that he's been able to just buckle down, fight for his freedom, educate himself about the process, everything.
For Darrell, using his time in prison to learn and grow and hope for a day that he's reunited with his family has helped him to stay sane.
The last decade in prison, for me to actually be able to endure this place, I had to use this as a period of incubation for me, growth and development, where I have came in here and learned a lot of things and immersed myself in the law, read a lot of books and working out and building a relationship with the Creator, Me to learn the knowledge of self and who I am to actually be changed into a different man, I wasn't a saint, but I'm not a sinner, We all are sinners, but I wasn't a saint, I wasn't a horrible guy. I have been changed, and I believe that I have so much more to give to not only our community of Detroit, but the world, My family,
And in terms of having so much to give to the world, how much would it mean to you to be reunited with your family outside of the prison setting?
That's everything. I can't wait to get there and just hug my mother, hug my sisters, They've been my number one advocates, That's what I wake up every day for, just to get to that moment to hold my mother in my hand.
Darrell and his mother analogize his case to a couple of other cases, including one that we covered in Undisclosed.
It's a bigger picture. So it's something that they feel like they can keep them there, and most people ain't gonna fight and ain't gonna do all the things that we did to get him back. Most of the time it takes 20, 30 years because people don't have nobody fighting with them. One man just got out 44 years with no DNA clears him. Something could have happened before 40.
Yeah, that's Ronnie Long. That's we covered Ronnie Long's case a couple years ago, and yeah, 44. That's 1976.
He was. Wow.
There's a striking similarity between the Ronnie Long case and Darrell Ewing's case, which is they both had alibis, strong alibis, but alibis by African-American witnesses. And as we see all too often in the American criminal justice system, jurors tend to reject alibis by African-American witnesses, even if there's no evidence refuting their recollections. Perhaps the most infamous case in this vein is the case made famous by Bryan Stevenson in his book Just Mercy and the ensuing film, the case of Walter McMillian.
I've seen that on. Have you ever seen the movie Just Mercy?
Yeah, and in Just Mercy too. I mean, it's a pattern we've seen in some of our cases when your alibi witnesses are African American. Oftentimes, unfortunately, the jury discredits them, which seems to have happened here.
For those who haven't heard of the case of Walter McMillian, he had African-American alibi witnesses who placed him in a family fish fry for the church where his sister was the minister. And despite six of those witnesses testifying that he was at the fish fry at the same time he was allegedly committing the murder, the jury still found him guilty. Moreover, McMillian remained behind bars for years despite someone else confessing to committing the crime. This is another point of parallel between the cases of Walter McMillian and Darrell Ewing.
Well, I know everything about it. I was there, and I actually was the shooter of that incident, sir.
Next time on Undisclosed. Thanks for listening to this week's Undisclosed. I'd like to thank the following people: Rebecca Lavoie for audio production, Christy Williams for website management, Mital Telhan, our executive producer. Of course, I'd like to thank our sponsors. As always, you can follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at the handle @UndisclosedPod, and you can support our Patreon @UndisclosedPod.